From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made the last time the Rochester Police Department interviewed a candidate for the job. Ask yourself something. What would you want to know about someone who hoped to become a police officer? What questions would you ask? What information would you try to acquire before giving them a badge and a gun? As our colleague at City reported recently, new police recruits in Rochester will be grilled by a panel of citizens who can recommend to the police chief whether they be hired or not. It's one of the final acts of the mayoral administration of Lovely Warren. The civilian public safety interview panel will be made up of 9 to 12 volunteers, and as far as we can tell, it's first of its kind in New York State. So what kinds of questions should police recruits expect to hear? Finelli writes that panelists will be tasked with questioning the recruits about topics such as attitudes on contemporary policing, life experiences, familiarity with Rochester, implicit bias. Interviews would not take place until after a recruit completes physical training and background checks. The man behind this plan is, first and foremost, the Reverend Lewis Stewart of United Christian Leadership Ministries. Throughout the past year and a half, there has been a kind of split in activist circles about the future of policing in this community, yes, but also in this country. Some have called, as we know, for outright abolition of the police. But this country has essentially made it clear that is not going to happen. The vast majority of Americans of all backgrounds don't want the abolition of police, and Reverend Stewart is among them. He wants qualified, well-trained, carefully selected police who will treat citizens fairly, and he believes this plan is a step in that direction. Let's talk about how it's going to work here. Reverend Lewis Stewart, president of United Christian Leadership Ministries, nice to see you in studio, sir.
Good seeing you also, Evan.
And Frank Liberti is on the line with us. Frank is former president of the Center for Dispute Settlement. Hi, Frank. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Reverend, can I just start on that, the last point that I mentioned there? I think it's important here just because of the amount of time and oxygen that has been spent on the question of police abolition. A year ago, a year and a half ago, after the murder of George Floyd, you were on this program saying, we're not going there. This country's not going there. Republicans may not want it, but neither do Democrats largely. White people may not want it, but neither do Black people largely. This is not, there's a shared agreement that we're not going to abolish the police, but we have to do much, much better. Is that still where you are?
That's still where I'm at. We can see in the context and in the light of the recent, I would say, 76, 77 murders in Rochester alone, that people of color, Black people, have been calling for police presence. The only thing that we want the police to do, as you said, Evan, is to treat people fairly, with non-racist attitudes, non-racist behavior, and to enforce constitutional rights. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, I am not for the abolishment of the police at all. That does not work. That will not work. What we advocate for is a re-envisioning and reimagining of police and what true community policing should be about.
And Reverend, in the wake of the case involving Kyle Rittenhouse, there are some who have argued that if we truly had an abolition of police and we relied, quote unquote, on communities to protect themselves, we would have more Kyle Rittenhouses. Do you think that's a fair argument?
I think that is a very fair argument. In a sense, in the book of Judges, it talks about where every man became a law unto himself. You would have chaos in the community. You have chaos in the streets. Justice would be in the hands of a mob or an individual. And we need to be a society, basically, that's based on law. Law that's going to respect the rights of everyone. So, yes, I certainly agree with what you had to say.
Tell me a little bit about how you and Frank and Frank's role here and what you envision your role and how this all came together, Reverend.
Okay, great. This Citizens Public Safety Interview Panel is unique and significant. It is the only one of its kind in New York State, and that has been implemented by Mayor Warren. We've had a committee working on this, including my friend Frank Liberti. The mayor had assigned former chief of police Cynthia Harriet Sullivan to help with this process. And then she, in turn, assigned Deputy Chief of Administration Debbie Dwyer. We've all been working on this just to look at the context of how the police are going to play a role in this, as well as citizens in the community. So this really is a call for citizen involvement at the basic level to interview candidates before they become sworn police officers. We want to make sure and look at candidates' attitudes, look at what issues they may have, feel out what implicit biases they may have, to make sure that they are a good cultural fit for the community, that they respect the community. As you well know, 93% of RPD officers live outside of the city. And we need officers, basically, that are going to have the community at heart and really represent the community and have citizen engagement in every aspect of law enforcement.
Yeah, and Frank, let me just ask you a little bit about sort of enforcement power here, because as I understand it, this panel can make recommendations, but the panel's not going to have final say if a candidate doesn't get hired or fired. Hired or none, I should say. And Frank, to me, there's a parallel to some of the work that you did at the Center for Dispute Settlement. You were able to examine police conduct, respond to some claims, but ultimately you couldn't go in and tell the police chief, this officer should be fired, this officer needs to be disciplined. You can make a recommendation. That being said, do the recommendations carry weight as you see it, Frank?
Well, yeah, as far as enforcement, there is no ultimate enforcement. It's the chief of police decision. The way I think we look at this is that the, we have the PAB is looking for disciplinary authority for police officers. And that is up in the courts now and on appeal. So regardless of where that goes, my personal background in years and years of human resources labor relations experience, over 25 years of that, actually writing, imposing, and defending discipline, I think, from my perspective, I think we need to hold the chief of police accountable for the actions of the police officers. So in that sense, we don't have the authority to insist that the chief doesn't hire a candidate. We'll make this three-person civilian panel will interview potential candidates and make one of three recommendations: that the candidate's highly recommended, that the candidate's recommended, or that the candidate's not recommended at this time. And then leave that ultimate decision to the chief of police. Now it's up to the chief of police who serves at the pleasure of the mayor to hold those officers accountable mm-hmm. for their actions. This is really an attempt to begin to hopefully change police culture. The idea here is we want to draw the citizens together so that they have input into recommending who is going to be a police officer in our city. And it's an attempt to shift the power relationship for police officers to recognize that they're subservient and accountable directly to the community, and also that they become more familiar with and sensitive to the people who are they're called on to protect and serve.
Yeah, and let me just follow that point. And as I do that, I will let our audience know. I already have some emails. We'll get to them. Listeners, if you want to share your thoughts, if you've got questions about how this might work, if you're interested in a position on the panel interviewing candidates for Rochester police officer positions, if you've got ideas on what you would want future possible police officers to tell you or to tell about themselves or to reveal about themselves, what are the kind of questions you would want to ask? What's the information you'd want to have? You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. And Frank, just following the point on recommendations, you're right. Right now, the Police Accountability Board is in court, and there is a new appeal that will be heard regarding disciplinary power. And the PAB wants disciplinary power, and you can understand why. The Police Accountability Board is saying we should be independent. It shouldn't just be a recommendation. We should have some authority here. They may not get it. So far, they have not won in court on that. And as far as I can tell, this is their last shot at that. We'll see where this goes. But they've also made the argument, Frank, that even if we don't get disciplinary power, when we make recommendations, if those recommendations are ignored by the police, in other words, let's say in some hypothetical scenario, they found a police officer acted inappropriately or violently or too aggressively, et cetera, and they make a recommendation for discipline, and that's ignored, they will be public. They will let the public know that the department is ignoring their findings, and they believe that will carry some weight and some pressure. Similarly, Frank, if you are routinely saying, not recommended at this time, not recommended at this time, we found some red flags, not recommended at this time, and those candidates continue to be hired, can you be public to the extent of, I don't know how much you can reveal about individuals, but can you say to the public, look, we're making these recommendations and they're not being followed?
Yeah, I think we'd be able to do that without giving out any specifics as to names. In fact, I fully agree with the idea, and actually, we made this suggestion to City Council as they were evaluating directions to go in the future, and that ultimately led to the Police Accountability Board's enforcement powers. We made recommendations that, we at the Center for Dispute Settlement were reviewing police complaints for over 35 years, and we were held bound by this confidentiality in the legislation that City Council opposed. We requested a change in that when the change in 50A was revoked, when 50A was revoked, allowing police disciplinary records to be disclosed. The recommendation was that any time that the civilian review panel made a recommendation that was not agreed to by the chief of police, that they would have to, at a city council meeting, articulate their rationale as to their disagreement. So I fully agree with you that public disclosure is really important, and that gets back to the point. You know, the chief of police serves at the pleasure of the mayor, who is an elected official. We need to be able to hold the chief of police accountable to the person and to the city, and also to the mayor that appoints that chief, to articulate their reason for disagreeing with what the citizens have recommended.
Okay, go ahead, Frank. Yep.
No. In the same sense, so we would be making those recommendations if they're not adhered to without being specific because of the confidentiality. I think it would be important to bring that to light. That, you know, we're making these recommendations to the chief of police, and in some cases, he or she is not abiding by those recommendations.
Yeah, I understand completely. All right, before we get into what our guests think candidates need to be revealing in terms of what they should be asked, et cetera, I want to listen to one short sound cut here, because listeners may be wondering what the next mayoral administration will say about this. And I don't mean Jim Smith, who takes over for a month starting on Wednesday. I'm talking about Malik Evans. But Mayor Lovely Warren, at a recent news conference about this and some other matters, was asked if she consulted with Mayor-elect Malik Evans about that. Here's what she had to say.
We have one mayor at a time, and right now I'm still the mayor.
We have one mayor at a time, and right now I'm still the mayor. So I don't presume that Mayor-elect Evans, Reverend Stewart, would oppose this, but do you know, how does he feel about this civilian advisory panel?
I think from knowing Mayor-elect Evans, that he is concerned about the violence in Rochester, definitely. He has articulated that. And also the fact that he understands the need for reinventing or reimagining policing. I did put a call into him today for him to call me back so that we can sit down and meet on this particular issue. So I have not heard from him his response yet, but hopefully that will happen. The other thing is that the mayor and I and Frank and others were there. We signed an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, which is binding, basically, according to the city corporate council. On the administration, the next administration, for this citizens interview panel. But at the same time, it behooves me to get together with him and sit down and talk and say, let's be on the same page with this.
So you'll try to do that soon?
Absolutely.
Okay. An email from a listener named Charles says, Evan, why do I get the distinct feeling that absolutely none of the selected civilians for this panel will have any policing experience whatsoever? Reverend Stewart, does that matter to you? Should there be former police officers on a panel like this?
No, there should not be former police officers on a panel because basically that goes against the creation of what we need. That is citizens from the community being involved in this. But here's what's going to happen. Citizens, and Frank, I can defer to you on this also, or you also can add to this. We'll go to the police academy, and I believe for 10 Mondays at about maybe, is it 2 hours every Monday, Frank, or something like that?
That's what's scheduled, yes.
Yes, to look at what policing is about, what the purpose of policing, and what the police are engaged in. At the same time, Frank will be teaching the interviewees on the panel in terms of interviewing questions and things of that sort. Let's look at the requirements. The minimum
to get on this panel.
Yeah, to be on this panel. The minimum requirement says the person must be a resident of the city of Rochester, must be at least 21 years of age, must have a high school diploma or GED, pass a criminal record check, and commit to serving at least 3 years on this panel because we don't want a big flux of people going in and out. You know, we want some steady people who've gained the experience in terms of interviewing, what to look for, who will have gone through this police academy for 10 weeks, attend the civilian police interview panel training, and be available during business hours to conduct candidate interviews. So those are the basic requirements. People who are interested in this, who are city residents, can go to the city website and fill out an application there online.
There's also a note that says they should be involved in their neighborhood. Is that part of what you want, people who are involved in their community?
Well, they can be involved in their community. They can be involved in a positive way in wanting to make some changes, some progressive changes, and some reforms. We want people who are definitely interested in accountability and in transparency. Now, remember, the fact is we talk about the police being accountable and transparent. This holds, on the other end, the community accountable and transparent to be involved in true community policing.
Okay. I see the phone's ringing. People are interested. We're going to get comments in a second, but let me ask both the Reverend Lewis Stewart and Frank Liberty, who have been working on this new citizens panel, this community panel of how many total, by the way? How many people?
We're talking about at least 12.
About a dozen people who are going to be questioning recruits and candidates for Rochester police officers in the future before they make recommendations. And as Frank said, either highly recommended, recommended, or not recommended hires for the police department. Reverend, if you are on this panel, what are the first questions that you need to know from a recruit who wants to be a Rochester police officer?
Well, some of the questions I would like to know is, I'm not going to be on the panel, personally.
I know that, but I'm curious to know what you want them asking.
But I'm going to defer that to Frank because Frank is going to be doing the training.
All right, Frank, what should they be asking?
Yeah, so we have some draft questions that once we come up with these 9 to 12 interviewers, we'll go through those questions to make sure everybody's comfortable with them. Some of the draft questions are, where do you presently live, and what kind of activities have you been involved in the place that you live? Are you familiar with the city of Rochester? What neighborhoods do you feel most comfortable in? What are your thoughts about community policing, and how is that similar to what you've seen police do in the past, and how is that different from how you might envision it? What is your response to some of the incidents across the country and right here in Rochester, with the Daniel Prude situation? How do you think policing should have addressed that, or the same way or differently? To try to get an understanding of what these candidates believe their role would be if they were to be selected as a police officer in the city. As the Reverend said, they would go through the traditional police academy in the Center for Dispute Settlement. We had trained citizens from the people from the city of Rochester sitting on those three-person panels reviewing investigations of police complaints. And we would insist that all of those people were trained, certified neutrals so that they didn't bring any hidden bias into their decision-making and would be looking at the objective information in that investigation before they made a recommended decision to the chief of police. And they would also be required to take a 40-hour class in what, if you're expected to judge whether a police officer acted appropriately or not, what is the expectation from the police department for that officer's behavior? So we believe it's very important that they have at least a basic understanding of the expectations of a police officer. Keep in mind that we're trying to introduce here new candidates to be police officers who bring with them a different perspective and a cultural and hopefully a cultural change throughout the ranks. It'll be a slow process because they won't be hiring tons and tons of police officers, but very slowly we hope that this will have an impact, a direct impact on policing and how it's done in the city of Rochester and change the culture there. And that's done through, it has to come from the top.
Starting when? I mean, you're right. I mean, it's not like there's a whole new set of interviews that could happen tomorrow, but when could a civilian panel actually be convened to start working?
Well, right now, I believe that they're just now beginning a new academy. They've already made selections, so that we anticipate that the next class would probably be in the fall of 2022.
Yes.
So fall. So you got some time, and just let me follow up with one point with Frank and Reverend Stewart, and then Maud, Hillary on the phone. Please hang there. We're going to take your calls in just a second. Frank, when you talk about uncovering bias in a candidate, that's a worthy goal for any organization, especially police. But what are the right questions and how do you know and feel confident that you can make a recommendation against hiring somebody because what you uncovered was that they're harboring some kind of bias, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, the other training that these interviewers will receive is training that really focuses on what is implicit bias. And those interviewers, we'll have an in-depth discussion on implicit bias, keeping in mind that these interviewers need to understand their own implicit bias. So, and the importance of understanding that when they begin to interview these candidates. And so you would ask situational questions. And then follow those up with more questions in response to the candidate's responses to begin to understand where that person is coming from, what their underlying ideas and thoughts are, and how they maybe respond to the idea of implicit bias. Do they believe they have implicit bias? Do they believe they don't have implicit bias? And again, in a situational question, I think you can begin to explore that in more in depth. In asking questions about what they feel about policing, particularly in the communities of color, and get a response from that. Is there any 100% guarantee? No. So we'll try and avoid questions, the situational questions that you're really begging the answer.
Mm-hmm, right.
But try a more subtle approach to see where that person's candor and honesty is about their underlying thoughts about what they view their role as a police officer would be.
Okay. Reverend, how do you feel about uncovering bias, and are you confident it can be done in this fashion with civilians interviewing possible police candidates?
I think so. I think all of us have implicit biases or biases in that sense. But in this situation, we want the best people as servant leaders or servant servants in the community.
So what's a red
servant
flag
for protectors? You? I would say, for example, you hear from a lot of white police officers, none here in Rochester who would admit it, but certainly from my reading and others is the fact that when they see a black man, there's automatically this temperature of fear arises, and you equate black with criminality. And so how that would be interposed in a question to ferret out what that kind of thinking is something that the interviewers would be doing, because I think it's important. I think it's important in terms of what kind of cultural baggage one brings into policing, which would be indicative of how one is going to carry out a policing function, regardless now of what laws you have in place, what procedures and processes that you have in place. I think that's going to be very important.
All right. A lot of emails and phone calls as we talk about this new, roughly a dozen people will make up a citizens panel that is going to be designed to interview and make recommendations on police hires for Rochester. It's a new idea. We haven't really seen it done in New York State before. And Reverend Lewis Stewart, president of United Christian Leadership Ministries, is the first person behind it, supported by Frank Liberti, former president of the Center for Dispute Settlement, and with the support of the city of Rochester, the outgoing administration of Mayor Lovely Warren, presumably the next administration, and they'll have a lot of work to do. So let me take some phone calls here. This is Maud in Rochester. Hi, Maud. Go ahead.
Oh, well, as I was telling your person, I was involved with the PACTAF team in the mid-'80s in what is now called the South Wedge, and that's my old neighborhood. And we became the eyes and ears of the people and the police who couldn't be at every station. We reported to Highland Section on South Avenue, and to this day I still feel it's very important to have a local center, a community center where police can be contacted and their presence is felt in the neighborhood. And so when we did our patrols, we would check business doors to make sure they were locked after hours. And we had a really good camaraderie with the police department. I even was inspired to take the academy exam in 83.
But do you feel the relations with the police have changed significantly, Maud?
Well, I had a lovely discussion with a police officer responding to a complaint just 2 days ago. And he was very young, but he was very open-minded and very well-versed. And, I was very enthused that type of candidate would make it to the police force. You know, I would be interested in being on a review board that spoke to candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. And Maud said went through the academy exam in 1983. We appreciate the phone call, Maud. So if someone like Maud says, hey, I'll put my hand up, I'll be considered for this. Again, Reverend Stewart, how do people get considered for this?
Well they get considered for this by number one, applying. And then number three, all interviewers will be go before a three-person committee, and that three-person committee will ask them questions about why they want to be selected to be on the panel. But let me just say this: I respect what she's talking about, but the purview of the interview panel is certainly far different than the purview of PACTAC.
Yeah.
The purview of the interview panel is not to check doors or patrol in the neighborhood or anything like that.
It's hiring the right people, right?
It's just hiring the right people to do the policing in the community.
Okay, fair enough. Maud, thank you for that. Let me get Christy next in Monroe County. Hi, Christy, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I just have a comment just about how much of a hard sell it is for me that officers will be policing communities that they're not from. I just wonder, how can we assure that there's a, you know, a social incentive, an emotional incentive, that they'll protect communities that they're not actually a part of? So suburban officers, you know, coming in from these surrounding suburbs to police areas in the city where there are large, you know, racial differences, there are large economic differences. It's just a very hard sell for me that people who are from very, very different communities will have social and emotional incentives to protect the people of those communities.
Do you want to see a residency requirement, Christy?
Yeah, I think that would be great. I think that's a really good step. I think, you know, there are other cities that they don't have, the models don't have residency requirements, but it's more like a model where we, where they are, they're getting the police officers from the communities, essentially. They're developing police forces within those communities. Yeah. They're not even police forces.
Yeah, know. Absolutely. Yeah. Christy, it's a great question. And to Christy's point, there's multiple ways that you can pursue this goal. Most police departments in this country will now tell you, yes, we want officers from our community. And you could try to recruit more heavily from a pool of candidates from a city. You can set a residency requirement, or you can grandfather it in. You could say starting now, 50% have to be from the city, 75, 100. Everything I'm told, I'll ask both Reverend and Frank about this. Reverend, everything I'm told about this is that if you set a residency requirement, first of all, you can't do it and say it's for everybody right now. You'd lose a bunch of officers.
Right.
And even going forward, you'd massively shrink the pool. But others argue, fine, shrink the pool. It's more important. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, I think as we go forward, we have to have residency requirements for police officers in the city if they're going to serve and protect the community. That's number one. Number two, and Frank can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's up to the state legislature, I believe, to set residency requirements for police officers. The third thing is we have a shrinking pool of police hirees anyway. I think at one time, a couple of years back, it used to be 2,000 or 3,000. Now it's down to a couple of hundred because people just don't want to become police officers any longer because of the suspicion, the animosity against police officers because of what some police officers have done. It's all a mix here, and somehow we've got to bridge that gap and go beyond that to see how we can recruit more officers from black and brown communities who are willing to be servant protectors in their community.
Frank, you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I do. The Reverend Stewart is right. It would take a legislative action. The concern, restriction, civil service employment restriction doesn't allow for residency requirements for police officers. So there's a big push for a legislative change to change that civil service requirement. And I couldn't agree more with Christy. We need police officers who are tied to our community. And this is I'm being redundant with a lot of other folks, but you know, we pay police officers who in large part take their salaries and spend it out in communities that are not in the city. And it really hurts the city as far as financial and you know, the city is paying people who are spending their dollars outside the city. We need people who can live in the city, pay taxes in the city and pay property tax. And support our schools. So I couldn't agree more that that's important. However, it will require some legislative changes. Keep in mind, there's another thing. The Rochester Police Force has been under consent decree to hire minorities that goes way back into the early 1970s. Judge Valeska put that consent decree in. But even the consent decree has become problematic. Because that consent decree, if I'm not mistaken, says that you cannot hire more than 25%. You must hire close to 25% minorities. But the issue is now, if we do a great recruitment effort in minority communities and get a lot of applicants, we're restricted to no more than 25% of a new academy to being minority employees. So there are some underlying legislative and judicial restrictions that have to be dealt with.
Yeah, that's a good point. And maybe our state legislators can address those questions on future programs. Yeah. Rich in Rochester next on the phone. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hey. Hey. How you doing?
Good, sir.
Evan.
Yep. Good, sir.
My point is that I know that it's great that we're doing all this training and stuff, but I think this has got to be a top-down, bottom-up cultural change that has to be constantly worked as far as sexual and racism sensitivity, all types of sensitivities, and it has to be attacked at all levels at all times, because just, I don't care if you give 100 hours of a class, it has to be endemic within the system itself and has to be rooted out at every level. And I wonder what kind of work is to be done in that sense, not only in your new recruits, but the 20-year-old veterans. What's going on?
Okay. Frank, you want to address that?
But that takes me back to, you know, all my years of work in public sector labor relations, you know, correcting employee behavior, and I will say this, and I think it's true in my experience, it's true with the Rochester Police Force. You have about 3 or 4% of the population that are really have aberrant behavior, but they have a large influence on a lot of other police officers. In this case, I think we have to recognize that the most influential person in the police force is that sergeant who doesn't address those inappropriate comments, inappropriate actions that are minor. And by not addressing that just tacitly condones more and more egregious behavior. We have to start there. But I agree directly with Rich. It comes from the top down. It gets me back to if the PAB does get disciplinary power, that could have the effect of diluting the authority from the police chief, who I believe is the person that has to have changed that culture from the top down, particularly with those frontline supervisors that, in this case, are sergeants.
I wonder if this is where the Reverend will disagree with you. Go ahead, Reverend.
No, I agree with Frank in the sense that it starts with the sergeant. I mean, with the chief, and the chief has got to really enforce certain rules of behavior that police will adhere to. But that has not been done fully, as far as I'm concerned. And basically, it's that lieutenant and that sergeant really that's got to enforce. We have a proposal, and we're working on it, is that if you look at the, and it has to be done from the academy level statewide. I think what they did in terms of a police curriculum is encapsulate sexual harassment, implicit bias, and something else in about, let's say, 5 to 10 hours of training. And basically, the majority of the training is on use of force, et cetera. We're saying, well, you need to look at that. Less use of force and more on de-escalation and more on racial justice education training. That's what needs to be done. We don't get enough of that. And we have proposed at least 40 hours of racial justice education training per year, as well as de-escalation training. And so the emphasis really needs to be put on that, and that's how we're going to change that culture from the top down.
Let me read an email from a listener named Nancy, who has a couple of criticisms. Her first says, she says, saying that recruits for the police will be, quote, grilled by citizen panel members is a biased statement. The implication is that the citizens are adversarial by definition rather than a part of a process that has shared goals. Nancy, I was quoting our colleague Gino Finelli from City Magazine when I read that, but I don't disagree with that. The word grilling to me just means intensively questioning for the purpose of gaining the best information possible. I was grilled before I got this job. You might have been grilled before you got lots of grilling going on. I'm a big fan of grilling. in the backyard and for every candidate for a job. And I think you can do that with shared goals here. So I didn't mean that to be adversarial. I understand how you took it, Nancy, but I think it just means this panel is going to be convened to do some hard, important work to try to get to the bottom of who these candidates are and whether they would be good fits for the Rochester Police Department. So that's how I would characterize that. She says the binary created by framing the funding of police as either total abolition or not does not capture the more sophisticated arguments being made around police reform. The majority of people calling for abolition are talking about restructuring policing and redistributing funds spent in enforcement to community supports. That is true, Nancy, and we have definitely covered that extensively on this program. I am addressing, in particular, the occasional emails and phone calls I get from people who still say, abolish, abolish, abolish. We can police ourselves. We don't need police anymore. It comes up. It is not, you know, a mainstream view, but it's not just a small outlier. That's why we started from the basis saying the reform is, the question of reform is, we're going to have police. What does it look like? And I don't think Reverend Stewart disagrees with you. I think redistributing funds to community supports, asking should police be sent to every mental health call instead of, you know, mental health experts, Reverend? I mean, there's lots of ways to reform this, right?
Yeah, there are lots of ways to reform. Let me answer her question. It's two parts. Number one, I had to apply for being a pastor, and I was interviewed. And if you want to call that grilling,
well,
I was
a grilling.
Right, but it wasn't adversarial.
Yeah, I got you.
It's just to get at where you stand on a particular issue and your concern about it. Secondly is the fact that when you begin to distribute monies to basically community organizations, that still does not get at the heart of how do you change policing. You can distribute monies and defund the police all you want, but that's not going to change police culture. How do we change police culture? How do we change the institution of policing? How do we get law enforcement to relate to the community and to treat the community fairly with justice and understanding and upholding the constitutional rights of everyone? That's what we need to get at. So all day long, you can give monies to community organizations, unless you get at the core of changing policing, everything is going to remain the same.
All right. Daniel's got comments that I'll kick to both of our panelists today. Daniel says, I would ask police candidates, what is your educational background? I feel that a strict criminal justice education leaves out the understanding of humanity and empathy that a more liberal arts and science education would provide. I would also ask, what do you feel policing is for? I would look for a broad and open-minded understanding of the purpose of policing. That's from Daniel. Frank Liberti, how do you feel about those questions?
Those are great questions. You know, those are the types of questions that once these interviewers are selected, that we would hope to develop. Those are, you know, really critical questions. You know, trying to understand what is it that draws you to want to be a police officer. How do you see policing happening in your mind? What have you seen in the past? What do you see in the future of policing? Those are critical questions. And again, to get back to the whole idea of bias, and let me talk from a personal perspective. I'm an old white guy, and I know that myself that I have implicit bias, and I get those knee-jerk reactions. The difference is that everybody has to recognize you do have implicit bias, but recognizing it gives you an opportunity not to act on it. And that's where the critical distinction is. Once you acknowledge you have implicit bias, then you understand that can lead you to inappropriate actions if you don't check that. Mm-hmm. So just understanding and appreciating that everyone has implicit bias. And we use some pretty dramatic information on that. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt. She's a professor out of Stanford University. Her field of she's an African-American scholar. She's a social scientist out of Stanford. Her field of study is policing and policing impact, particularly in communities of color. She's highly regarded, highly recognized. And when we get these the training for these interviewers, we'll share some of her experiences in that. But she has a very dramatic story that she tells that I won't relate the full thing here, where actually she has an experience with a 5-year-old son who comes out with really knee-jerk reaction and implicit bias against another black man. And she uses that to reinforce the idea. Where does this 5-year-old kid who mm-hmm. grew up with a mother whose work life work is that come up with these implicit suggestions about the danger of black men? This surrounds our culture. So we use that, particularly when we've used this in training police officers too, to relay the idea that first thing you have to do is you have to acknowledge that we all have implicit bias. That is the key to beginning a process where you don't act on those knee-jerk reactions.
Hmm. Anything you want to add there, Reverend?
I think Frank is perfectly correct in that. I do know I worked at the New York State Department of Corrections for about 20 years. And the majority of correctional officers there were white. The majority of the prisoners there were people of color, black and brown. And so the expectation was that, you know, if you are black and brown, you're going to be a criminal. I was a chaplain there, and one white inmate told me that a white CO came to him and said, "What are you doing here? You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be whipped and such and such, because this place is only for black and brown people, not you."
Well, I've got to let Frank go here a couple minutes early, so let me just kick one more question to Frank. This comes from a listener who says, "How publicly known will the interview panelists be who are selected for this panel? Seems that in these times, many folks will not want to be widely known to serve on such panels." Frank, what are you looking for here?
We're looking for people that actually acknowledge their own bias and come in without any preconceived notions, adversarial or supportive of police, and ability to take a neutral ground. Now, keep in mind, we have the Police Accountability Board empowered, and it's a watchdog approach to oversight for law enforcement. And so that needs to be balanced, I think, with trying to change the culture by having people on this panel who recognize their own bias and are able to set that aside and not bring an anti-police or pro-police bias into that.
Right.
I think that is a critical factor to balance off, you know, the idea that we acknowledge that we need police, and I fully acknowledge that we need to reinvest in policing or we reinvest in public safety. And some of that, you know, might be taking away some of the responsibilities that we expect police officers to deal with. You know, and as mentioned before, you know, going responding to a mental health situation. You know, these police officers aren't trained to interact in those situations. Why do we have to send police to do that? So that's part of the reinventing. Mm-hmm. But you know, when police need to respond to, you know, potentially violent situation, again, they need to be aware of their own biases and how they're interacting with the people.
But they can be, these panelists can be well known. They could be people that are not household names in Rochester, right? You're not just looking for well-known community figures, right, Frank?
No,
I would say we're looking for people that are in touch with their community.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Frank, I'm going to let you go because I know you got to run. Thanks for making the time for the program.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Frank's former president of the Center for Dispute Settlement. Let me sneak in one more phone call. This is Sean in Rochester. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hello. So I guess it's a little bit of a comment, but I guess a question, too. Frank is gone, so it was going to be to him. But so the history of police is one that was they were developed for two reasons. One, mostly in the South, was for slave control. And the other in the North actually was for crowd control, dealing with the onset of the rise of industrial revolution and capitalism. So those two things are the main driving force for the creation of police in America and actually in all in Western civilization. So my question and comment kind of together is, do you think it was to Frank, but do you think that we can reinvent, as he just said, police in a new way while we're still locked in those systems that were the main force and driving force for the creation of those police.
Well, and I'll let Reverend answer this. I mean, look, there were slave patrols, as they were called. Yes, but there are also police, there are police departments in places of the world that were not typically societies that had slavery. So, and there are not very many modern places that would want to abolish them, whether they had slavery or not, as a history. So I don't know. I mean, I understand some of the history, but I think some of it gets a little convoluted. Reverend, what would you say to that?
Yeah, let me address that. And thank you for asking that question. Policing in America came from out of England, which under Robert Peel, P-E-E-L. And there were three strands historically for policing in America. One, as you said, in the South, located primarily in the South as slave catchers. Then on the frontier to deal with your criminality, your outlaws, et cetera. And then in the North, and not necessarily for crowd control in the North, but they were really to keep the poor and the working class in their place. It was dealing with basically class economic control. And to protect the wealthy and the elite, especially in the northeast areas of the city. So you had those three things there. I would say that due to what's happening with all the controversial incidents with the past decade, with black people being killed by police, I really think that you see a movement abroad really to reimagine and to reinvent policing and to look at transparency and accountability. And I think it's in our hands to do so. Because if we don't do it now, we are never going to do it. And let me get back to something else.
20 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. Is that this policing panel, this panel is about empowering people in the community to take control over their own destiny and their own institutions, which impact them. And instead of impacting them negatively, to impact them positively.
So this citizens review panel asking questions and, I'm going to use the word again, grilling possible police candidates. They're going to be impaneling them over the next coming months here. The City of Rochester's website for more information. Reverend Stewart, great having you as always, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
All right.
To see you.
Hanukkah Light special programming coming up here on your local NPR and public radio.